Mars, Cassette 19. Under her hand, Michelle stiffened. Nadia had a stricken look. Maya knew she had said something wrong. Even Sax looked somehow pinched, almost distraught. Maya stared at the young man in the photo, stared and stared. Nothing came to her. She left the apartment. She walked up the steep streets of Odessa, past all the whitewash and the turquoise doors and shutters, the cats and the terracotta flower boxes, until she was high in the town and could look out over the indigo plate of the Hellas Sea for many kilometers. As she walked, she cried, but without knowing why, a curious desolation. And yet this, too, had happened before. Sometime later, she found herself in the west part of the upper town. There was the Parade Platz Park, where they had staged a blood knot. Or had it been the Winter's Tale? Yes, the Winter's Tale. But there would be no coming back to life for them. Oh, well, here she was. She made her way slowly down the long staircase alleyways, down and down toward their building, thinking about plays, her spirits a bit lighter as she descended. But there was an ambulance there at the apartment gate, and feeling cold, as if ice water had been dashed over her, she veered away and continued past the building, down to the Corniche. She walked up and down the Corniche until she was too tired to walk. Then she sat on a bench. Across from her in a sidewalk cafe, a man was playing a wheezy bandoneon, a bald man with a white mustache, bags under his eyes, round cheeks, red nose. His sad music was right there in his face. The sun was setting and the sea was nearly still, each broad facet glistening with the viscous glassy luster that liquid surfaces sometimes display, all of it as orange as the sun winking out over the mountains to the west. She sat back, relaxing, and felt the sea breeze on her skin. Gulls planed overhead. Suddenly the sea's color looked familiar to her, and she remembered looking down from the Aries at the mottled orange ball that Mars had been, the untouched planet rolling below them after their arrival in orbit, symbol of every potential happiness. She had never been happier than that in all the time since. And then the feeling came on her again, the pre-epileptic aura of the Prescavue, the sea glittering, a vast significance suffusing everything, imminent everywhere, but just beyond reach, pressing in on things. And with a little pop, she got it. That very aspect of the phenomenon was itself the meaning. That the significance of everything always lay just out of reach, in the future, tugging them forward, that in special moments one felt this tidal tug of becoming as a sensation of sharp, happy anticipation, as she had when looking down on Mars from the Aries, the unconscious mind filled not with the detritus of a dead past, but with the unforeseeable possibilities of the live future. Ah, yes! Anything could happen. Anything. Anything. And so as the Prescavue washed slowly away from her, unseen again, and yet somehow this time comprehended, she sat back on the bench, full and glowing. Here she was, after all, and the potential for happiness would always be in her. Part 13. Experimental Procedures. At the last minute, Nergal went up to Sheffield. From the train station, he took the subway out to the Socket, not seeing a thing. Inside the vast halls of the Socket, he walked to the departure lounge, and there she was. When she saw him, she was pleased that he had come, but irritated that he had come so late. It was almost time for her to go. Up the cable, onto a shuttle, out to one of the new hollowed-out asteroids, this one particularly large and luxuriant. And then off, accelerating at a Mars gravity equivalent for a matter of months, until it could coast at several percent of the speed of light. For this asteroid was a starship, and they were off to a star near Aldebaran, where a Mars-like planet rolled in an Earth-like orbit around a sun-like sun. A new world, a new life. and Jackie was going. Nergal still couldn't quite believe it. He had gotten the message only 2 days before, hadn't slept, as he tried to decide whether this mattered, whether it was a part of his life, whether he ought to see her off, whether he ought to try to talk her out of it. Seeing her now, he knew he couldn't talk her out of it. She was going. "I want to try something new," she had said in her message, a voice record without a visual image. There, coming from his wrist, her voice. "There's nothing for me here now anymore. I've done my part. I want to try something new." The group in the starship asteroid were mostly from Dorsa Brevia. Nergal had called Charlotte to try to find out why. "It's complicated," Charlotte said. "There's a lot of reasons. This planet they're going to is relatively nearby, and it's perfect for terraforming. Humanity going there is a big step, the first step to the stars." "I know," Nergal had said. Quite a few starships had already left, off to other likely planets. The step had been taken. "But this planet is the best one yet, and in Dorsa Brevia, people are beginning to wonder if we don't have to get that distance from Earth to get a fresh start. The hardest part is leaving Earth behind. Now it's looking bad again. These unauthorized landings, it could be the start of an invasion. And if you think of Mars as being the new democratic society and Earth the old feudalism, then the influx can look like the old trying to crush the new before it gets too big. And they've got us outnumbered 20 billion to 2. And part of that old feudalism is patriarchy itself. So the people in Dorsa Brevia wonder if they can get a little bit more distance. It's only 20 years to Aldebaran, and they're going to live a long time. So a group of them are doing it. Families, family groups, childless couples, childless single people. It's like the first 100 going to Mars, like the days of Boone and Chalmers." And so Jackie sat on the carpeted floor of the departure lounge, and Nergal sat next to her. She looked down. She was smoothing the carpet with the palm of her hand, and then drawing patterns in the nap. Letters. "Nergal," she wrote. He sat down beside her. The departure lounge was crowded but subdued. People looked grave, wan, upset, thoughtful, radiant. Some were going, some were seeing people off. Through a broad window they looked into the interior of the socket, where elevator cars levitated in silence against the walls, and the foot of the 37,000-kilometer-long cable stood hovering 10 meters over the concrete floor. "So you're going," Nergal said. "Yes," Jackie said. "I want a new start." Nergal said nothing. "It will be an adventure," he said. True, he didn't know what else to say. In the carpet, she wrote, "Jackie Boone went to the moon." "It's an awesome idea when you think of it," she said. "Humanity spreading through the galaxy, star by star, ever outward. It's our destiny. It's what we ought to be doing. In fact, I've heard people say that that's where Hiroko is, that she and her people joined one of the first starships, the one to Barnard's star, to start a new world, spread Veriditas." "It's as likely as any other story," Nergal said. And it was true. He could imagine Hiroko doing it, taking off again, joining the new diaspora of humanity across the stars, settling the nearby planets, and then on from there, a step out of the cradle, the end of prehistory. He stared at her profile as she drew patterns on the carpet. This was the last time he would ever see her. For each of them, it was as if the other were dying. That was true for a lot of the couples huddled silently together in this room, that people should leave everyone they knew. And that was the first 100. That was why they had all been so very strange. They had been willing to leave the people they knew and go off with 99 strangers. Some of them had been famous scientists. All of them had had parents, presumably. But none of them had had children. And none of them had had spouses except for the 6 married couples who had been part of the 100. Single, childless people, middle-aged, ready for a fresh start. That was who they were. And now that was Jackie, too. Childless. Single. Nergal looked away, looked back. There she was, flush in the light. Fine-grained gloss of black hair. She glanced up at him, looked back down. "Wherever you go," she wrote, "there you are." She looked up at him. "What do you think happened to us?" she asked. "I don't know." They sat looking at the carpet. Through the window in the cable chamber, an elevator levitated across the floor, hovering upright as it moved over a piece to the cable. It latched on, and a jetway snaked out and enveloped its outer side. "Don't go," he wanted to say. "Don't go. Don't leave this world forever. Don't leave me. Remember the time the Sufis married us? Remember the time we made love by the heat of a volcano? Remember Zygote?" He said nothing. She remembered. "I don't know." He reached down and rubbed the nap of the carpet so that he erased the second "you." With his forefinger, he wrote "we." She smiled wistfully. Against all those years, what was a word? The loudspeakers announced that the elevator was ready for departure. People stood, saying things in agitated voices. Nergal found himself standing, facing Jackie. She was looking right at him. He hugged her. That was her body in his arms, as real as rock. Her hair in his nostrils. He breathed in, held his breath, let her go. She walked off without a word. At the entry to the jetway, she looked back once. Her face. And then she was gone. Later, he got a print message by radio from deep space. "Wherever you go, there we are." It wasn't true, but it made him feel better. That was what words could do. "Okay," he said as he went through his days wandering the planet. "Now I am flying to Aldebaran." The northern polar island had suffered perhaps more deformation than any other landscape on Mars. So Sachs had heard, and now, walking on a bluff edging the Chasma Borealis River, he could see what they meant. The polar cap had melted by about half, and the massive ice walls of Chasma Borealis were mostly gone. Their departure had been a thaw unlike any seen on Mars since the Middle Hesperian, and all that water had rushed every spring and summer down the stratified sand and less, cutting through them with great force. Declivities in the landscape had turned into deep sand-walled canyons, cutting downstream to the North Sea in very unstable watersheds, channelizing subsequent spring melts and shifting rapidly as slopes collapsed and landslides created short-lived lakes before the dams were cut through and carried off in their turn, leaving only beach terraces and slide gates. Sachs stood looking down on one of these slide gates now, calculating how much water must have accumulated in the lake before the dam had broken. One couldn't stand too close to the edge of the overlook. The new canyon rims were by no means stable. There were few plants to be seen, only here and there a strip of pale lichen color, providing some relief from the mineral tones. The Borealis River was a wide, shallow wash of tumbling glacial milk some 180 meters below him. Tributaries cut hanging valleys much less deep and dumped their loads in opaque waterfalls like spills of thin paint. Up above the canyons, on what had been the floor of Chasma Borealis, the plateau was cut with tributary streams like the pattern of veins in a leaf. This had been laminated terrain to begin with, looking as if elevation contours had been artfully incised into the landscape, and the stream cuts revealed that the French curve Lamine went down many meters, as if the map had marked the territory to a great depth. It was near midsummer, and the sun rode the sky all day long. Clouds poured off the ice to the north. When the sun was at its lowest, the equivalent of mid-afternoon, these clouds drifted south toward the sea in thick mists, colored bronze or purple or lilac or some other vibrant subtle shade. A thin scattering of Fellfield flowers graced the laminate plateau, reminding Sax of Arena Glacier, the landscape that had first caught his attention back before his incident. That first encounter was very difficult for Sax to remember, but apparently it had imprinted on him in the way ducklings imprinted on the first creatures they saw as their mothers. There were great forests covering the temperate regions, where stands of giant sequoia shaded pine understories. There were spectacular sea cliffs, home to great clouds of mewling birds. There were crater jungle terraria of all kinds, and in the winters there were the endless plains of sastrugi snow. There were escarpments like vertical worlds, vast deserts of red-shifting sands, volcano slopes of black rubble. There was every manner of biome, great and small. But for Sax, this spare rock bioscape was the best. He walked along over the rocks. His little car followed as best it could, crossing the tributaries of the Borealis upstream at the first car ford. The summertime flowering, though hard to pick out if one were more than 10 meters away, was nevertheless intensely colorful, as spectacular in its way as any rainforest. The soil created by these plants in their generations was extremely thin and would thicken only slowly, and augmenting it was difficult. All soil dropped in the canyons would wind up in the North Sea, and on the laminate terrain the winters were so harsh that soil availed little. It only became part of the permafrost. So they let the fell fields grow in their own slow course to tundra and saved the soil for more promising regions in the south, which was fine by Sax. It left for everyone to experience, for many centuries to come, the first aerial biome, so spare and un-Terran. Trudging over the rubble, alert for any plant life underfoot, Sax veered toward his car, which was now out of sight to his right. The sun was at much the same height it had been all day, and away from the deep, narrow new Chasma Borealis running down the broad old one, it was very hard to keep oriented. North could have been anywhere across about 180 degrees, basically behind him. And it would not do to walk casually into the vicinity of the North Sea somewhere ahead of him, because polar bears did very well on that littoral, killing seals and raiding rookeries. So Sax paused for a moment and checked his wrist pad maps to get a precise fix on his position and his car's. He had a very good map program in his wrist pad these days. He found he was at 31.63844 degrees longitude, 84.89926 degrees north latitude, give or take a few centimeters. His car was at 31.64114 degrees longitude and 84.86857 degrees north latitude. If he climbed to the top of this little breadloaf knoll to the west-northwest, up an exquisite natural staircase, he should see it. Yes, there it rolled at a lazy walking pace. And there in the cracks of this breadloaf, so apt, this anthropomorphic analogizing, was some small purple saxifrage, stubbornly hunkering down in the protection of broken rock. Something in the sight was so satisfying. The laminate terrain, the saxifrage in the light, the little car moving to its dinner rendezvous with him, the delicious weariness in his feet, and then something indefinable, he had to admit it, unexplainable, in that the individual elements of the experience were insufficient to explain the pleasure of it. A kind of euphoria. He supposed this was love. Spirit of place. Love of place. The areophany, not only as Hiroko had described it, but perhaps as she had experienced it as well. Ah, Hiroko, could she really have felt this good all the time? Blessed creature, No wonder she had projected such an aura, collected such a following. To be near that bliss, to learn to feel it oneself. Love of planet. Love of a planet's life. Certainly the biological component of the scene was a critical part of one's regard for it. Even Anne would surely have to admit that, if she were standing there beside him. An interesting hypothesis to test. Look, Anne, at this purple saxifrage. See how it catches the eye somehow. One's regard focused in the center of the curvy linear landscape. And so love, spontaneously generated. Indeed, this sublime land seemed to him a kind of image of the universe itself, at least in its relation of life to non-life. He had been following the biogenetic theories of Deleuze, an attempt to mathematicize on a cosmological scale something rather like Hiroko's Veriditas. As far as Sachs could tell, Deleuze was maintaining that Veriditas had been a thread-like force in the Big Bang, a complex border phenomenon functioning between forces and particles and radiating outward from the Big Bang as a mere potentiality until second-generation planetary systems had collected the full array of heavier elements, at which point life had sprung forth, bursting in little bangs at the end of each thread of Veriditas. There had been none too many threads, and they had been uniformly distributed through the universe, following the galactic clumping and partly shaping it, so that each little bang at the end of a thread was as far removed from the others as it was possible to be. Thus, all the life islands were widely separated in time-space, making contact between any two islands very unlikely, simply because they were all late phenomena and at a great distance from the rest. There hadn't been time for contact. This hypothesis, if true, seemed to Sachs a more than adequate explanation for the failure of SETI, that silence from the stars that had been ongoing for nearly 4 centuries now. A blink of the eye compared to the billion light-years that Deleuze estimated separated all life islands. So Veriditas existed in the universe like this saxifrage on the great sand curves of the polar island. Small, isolate, magnificent. Sachs saw a curving universe before him, but Deleuze maintained that they lived in a flat universe on the cusp between permanent expansion and the expand-contract model in a delicate balance. And he also maintained that the turning point, when the universe would either start to shrink or else expand past all possibility of shrinking, appeared to be very close to the present time. This made Sachs very suspicious, as did the implication in Deleuze, that they could influence the matter one way or the other. Stomp on the ground and send the universe flying outward to dissolution and heat death, or catch one's breath and pull it all inward to the unimaginable omega point of the eschaton. No. The first law of thermodynamics, among many other considerations, made this a kind of cosmological hallucination, a small god's existentialism. Psychological result of humanity's suddenly vastly increased physical powers, perhaps, or Deleuze's own tendencies to megalomania, he thought he could explain everything. In fact, Sachs was suspicious of all the current cosmology, placing humanity as it did right at the center of things time after time. It suggested to Sachs that all these formulations were artifacts of human perception only. The strong anthropic principles seeping into everything they saw, like color. Although he had to admit some of the observations seemed very solid and hard to accept as human perceptual intrusion or coincidence. Of course, it was hard to believe that the Sun and Luna looked exactly the same size when seen from Earth's surface, but they did. Coincidences happened. Most of these anthropocentric features, however, seemed to Sachs likely to be the mark of the limits of their understanding. Very possibly there were things larger than the universe, and others smaller than strings, some even larger plenum made of even smaller components, all beyond human perception, even mathematically. If that were true, it might explain some of the inconsistencies in Bao's equations, if One allowed that the four macro dimensions of time-space were in relation to some larger dimensions, like the six micro dimensions were to their ordinary four, then the equations might work quite beautifully. He had a vision of one possible formulation right there. He stumbled, caught his balance. Another small bench of sand, about three times the size of the normal one. Okay, on and up to the car. Now, what had he been thinking about? He couldn't remember. He had been thinking something interesting, he knew that. Figuring something out, it seemed like. But try as he might, he couldn't recall what it was. It bulked at the back of his mind like a rock in his shoe, a tip of the tongueism that never came through, most uncomfortable, even maddening. It had happened to him before, he seemed to recall, and more frequently, recently. Wasn't that true? He wasn't sure, but that felt right. He had been losing his train of thought, and then been unable to retrieve it, no matter how hard he tried. He reached his car without seeing his walk there. Love of place, yes. But one had to be able to remember things to love them. One had to be able to remember one's thoughts. Confused, affronted, he clattered about the car getting a dinner together, then ate it without noticing. This memory trouble would not do. Actually, now that he thought of it, losing his train of thought had been happening a lot, or so he seemed to remember. It was an odd problem that way, but certainly he had been aware of losing trains of thought, which seemed, in their blank aftermath, to have been good thoughts. He had even tried to talk into his wrist pad when such an accelerated burst of thinking began, when he felt that sense of several different strands braiding together to make something new. But the act of talking stopped the mentation. He was not a verbal thinker, it seemed. It was a matter of images, sometimes in the languages of math, sometimes in some kind of inchoate flow that he couldn't characterize. So talking stopped it. Or else the lost thoughts were much less impressive than they had felt, for the wrist recordings had only a few phrases, hesitant, disconnected, and most of all, slow. They were nothing like the thoughts he had hoped to record, which, especially in this particular state, were just the reverse. Fast, coherent, effortless. The free play of the mind. That process couldn't be captured. And it struck Sachs forcibly how little of anyone's thinking was ever recorded or remembered or conveyed in any way to others. The stream of one's consciousness, never shared except in thimblefuls, even by the most prolific mathematician, the most diligent diarist. So, very inconvenient, even irritating. No doubt the matter ought to be investigated, although memory was a notorious quagmire for brain science. And it was somewhat like the leaky roof problem. Immediately after such a lost train of thought, with the absent shape of it still in his mind, and the emotional excitation, it almost drove him mad. But as the content of the thought was forgotten, half an hour later it didn't seem much more significant than the slipping away of dreams in the minutes after waking. He had other things to worry about. Such as the death of his friends. Yelly Zudith, this time, a member of the First Hundred he had never known well. Nevertheless, he went down to Odessa, and after a memorial service, a lugubrious affair during which Sachs was frequently distracted by thoughts of Vlad, of Spencer, of Phyllis, and then of Anne, they returned to the Praxis building and sat in Michelle and Maya's apartment. It wasn't the same apartment they had lived in before the Second Revolution, but Michelle had taken pains to make it look much the same, as far as Sachs could recall. Something about Maya's therapy, as she was having more and more mental trouble. Sachs wasn't sure what the latest was. He had never been able to deal with the more melodramatic aspects of Maya, and he hadn't paid overmuch attention to Michelle's talk about her when the two of them last got together. It was always different, always the same. Now, however, he took a cup of tea from Maya and watched her go back into the kitchen, past the table on which Michelle's scrapbooks were spread. Face up was a photo of Frank that Maya had treasured long ago. She had had it taped to the kitchen cabinet by the sink in the apartment down the hall. Sachs remembered that most clearly. It was a kind of heraldic feature of those tense years, all of them struggling while the young Frank laughed at them. Maya stopped and looked down at the photo, stared at it closely, remembering their earlier dread, no doubt. Those who had gone before, so very long ago. But she said, "What an interesting face." Sax felt a chill in the pit of his stomach. So distinct, the physiological manifestations of distress. To lose the substance of a speculative train of thought, a venture into the metaphysical, that was one thing. But this, her own past, their past, it was insupportable, not to be abided. He would not abide it. Maya saw they were shocked, though she didn't know why. Nadia had tears in her eyes, not a common sight. Michelle looked stricken. Maya, sensing something seriously wrong, fled the apartment. No one stopped her. The others picked up the place. Nadia went to Michelle. "More and more like that," Michelle muttered, looking haunted. "More and more. I feel it myself. But for Maya..." He shook his head, looking deeply discouraged. Even Michelle could make nothing good of this. Michelle, who had worked his alchemy of optimism on all their previous reversals, making them part of his great story, the myth of Mars that he had somehow wrenched out of the daily morass. But this was the death of their story. Thus hard to mythologize. No, living on after the memory died was mere farce. Pointless and awful. Something was going to have to be done. Sachs was still thinking about this, sitting in a corner, absorbed in his wrist pad, reading a collection of abstracts from recent experimental work on the memory, when there came a thump from the kitchen and a cry from Nadia. Sachs rushed in to find Nadia and Art crouched over Michelle, who lay white-faced on the floor. Sachs called the concierge, and faster than he would have imagined possible, an emergency crew had barged in with their equipment and shouldered Art aside, big young natives who brusquely encased Michelle into their compact web of machinery, leaving the old ones as spectators only of their friends' struggle. Sachs sat down among the medics in their way and put a hand to Michelle's neck and shoulder. Michelle's breathing had stopped, his pulse as well. White-faced. The resuscitation attempts were violent, the electrical shocks tried at a variety of strengths, the subsequent shift to heart-lung machine accomplished with a minimum of fuss, and the young medics worked in near silence, talking among themselves only when necessary, seemingly unaware of the old ones sitting against the wall. They did all they could, but Michelle remained stubbornly, mysteriously dead. Of course, he had been upset by Maya's memory failure, but this didn't seem an adequate explanation. He had already been aware of Maya's problem, none more so, and he had been worried. So any single display of her problem shouldn't have mattered. A coincidence. A bad one. And of course, eventually, quite late that evening, actually, after the doctors had finally given up and taken Michelle downstairs and were clearing out their equipment, Maya returned, and they had to tell her what had happened. She was distraught, naturally. Her shock and anguish were too much for one of the young medics, who tried to comfort her. "That won't work," Sachs wanted to say, "I've tried that myself," and got himself struck in the face for his pains, which made him angry. He went out in the hall, sat down heavily. Sachs went out and sat beside him. He was weeping. "I can't do this anymore," the man said after a while. He shook his head, seemingly apologetic. "It's pointless. We come and do all we can, and it makes no difference. Nothing stops the quick decline." "Which is?" Zach said. The young man shrugged his massive shoulders, sniffed. "That's the problem. No one knows." "Surely there must be theories. Autopsies." "Heart arrhythmia," said one of the other medics curtly as he passed by with some equipment. "That's just a symptom," the sitting man snarled and sniffed again. "Why does it go arrhythmic? And why doesn't CPR restart it?" No one answered. Another mystery to be solved. Through the door, Sachs could see Maya crying on the couch, Nadia beside her like a statue of Nadia. Suddenly, Sachs realized that even if he found an explanation, Michelle would still be dead. Art was dealing with the medics, making arrangements. Sachs tapped at his wrist and looked at a list of titles for articles on quick decline. 8,361 titles in this index. There were literature reviews and tables assembled by AIs, but nothing that looked like a definitive paradigm statement. Still at the stage of observation and initial hypothesis, flailing. In many ways, it resembled the work on memory Sachs had been reading. Death and the mind. How long they had studied these problems, how long the problems had resisted. Michelle himself had commented on that, implying some deeper narrative that explained their unexplainables. Michelle, who had brought Sachs back from aphasia, who had taught him to understand parts of himself he hadn't even known existed. Michelle was gone. He wouldn't be back. They had carried the last version of his body out of the apartment. He had been around Sachs's age, about 220 years old. It was an advanced age by any previous standard. Why then this pain in Sachs's chest, this hot blur of tears? It didn't make sense. But Michelle would have understood. Better this than the death of the mind, he would have said. But Sachs wasn't so sure. His memory problems seemed less important now. Maya's as well. She remembered enough to be devastated after all. Him too. He remembered what was important. Strange to recall. He had been in her company immediately in the wake of the death of all three of her consorts, John, Frank, now Michelle. Each time it got worse for her, and the same for him. Michelle's ashes up in a balloon over the Hellas Sea. They saved a pinch for return to Provence. The literature on longevity and senescence was so vast and specialized that Sachs found it difficult at first to organize his usual assault on the material. Recent work on the quick decline was the obvious starting point, but understanding articles on the subject meant going back to their predecessors and coming to some fuller understanding of the longevity treatments themselves. This was an area Sachs had never understood more than superficially, shying away from it instinctively because of its messy, biological, inexplicable, semi-miraculous nature, a subject very near the heart of the great unexplainable, really. He had left it happily to Hiroko and to the supremely gifted Vladimir Taneyev, who, along with Ursula and Marina, had designed and overseen the first treatments and many major modifications since then. Now, however, Vlad was dead, and Sachs was interested. It was time to dive into Veriditas, into the realm of the complex. There was orderly behavior, there was chaotic behavior, and on the border, in their interplay, so to speak, lay a very large and convoluted zone, the realm of the complex. This was the zone in which Veriditas made its appearance, the place where life could exist. Keeping life in the middle of the zone of complexity was, in the most general philosophical sense, what the longevity treatments had been about. Keeping various incursions of chaos, like arrhythmia, or of order, like malignant cell growth, from fatally disrupting the organism. But now something was causing the gerontologically treated individual to go from negligible senescence to extremely rapid senescence, or even more disturbingly, straight from health to death, without senescence at all. Some heretofore unseen eruption of chaos or order into the border zone of the complex. This was how it seemed to him, in any case, at the end of one very long session of reading the most general descriptions of the phenomenon he could find, and it suggested certain avenues of investigation as well, in the mathematical descriptions of the complexity-chaotic border likewise the order complexity border. But he lost this holistic vision of the problem in one of his blankouts, the train of thought concerning the substance of the math gone forever. And it had probably, he tried to console himself afterward, been too philosophical a vision to do him any good anyway. The explanation, after all, was not going to be obvious, or else the massive concerted effort of medical science would have searched it out by now. On the contrary, it was likely to be something very subtle in the biochemistry of the brain, an arena that had resisted 500 years of effort to investigate it scientifically, resisted like the Hydra, every new discovery only suggesting another head full of mysteries. Nevertheless, he persevered. And over the course of a few weeks' absorbed reading, he certainly gave himself a better orientation in the field than he had ever had before. Previously, his impression had been that the longevity treatment consisted of a fairly straightforward injection of the subject's own DNA, the artificially produced strands reinforcing the ones already in the cells so that the breaks and errors that crept in over time were repaired and the strands generally strengthened. This much was true, but the longevity treatment was more than this, just as senescence itself was more than cell division error. It was, as one might have predicted, much more complicated than just breaking chromosomes. It was an entire complex of processes. And while some were well understood, others were not. Senescential action, aging, took place on every level. Molecule, cell, organ, organism. Some senescence resulted from hormonal effects that were positive for the young organism in its reproductive phase, and only later negative for the post-reproductive animal when in evolutionary terms it no longer mattered. Some cell lines were virtually immortal. Bone marrow cells and the mucus in the gut went on replicating for as long as their surroundings were alive, with no sign at all of time-related changes. Other cells, such as the non-replaced proteins in the lens of the eye, underwent change that was driven by exposure to heat or light, regular enough to function as a kind of biological chronometer.
This ends side one of cassette 19. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.